Welcome to another edition of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. Brought to you by our partners Dalmatian Productions, the Firehouse Tribune, FireTech, makers of on-scene soot and ash decon products, Hennessy Distributing, your source for the new cool towel, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004, and the 2017 Great Florida Fire School. We'll be right back with today's show right after these important messages. How would you like 5 days of quality fire training in sunny Southwest Florida? There will be all types of classes, including hot classes, and some of the biggest names in the fire service today, all for an incredibly low registration fee. That's right. Join us at the Great Florida Fire School, November 8th through the 12th, at Fort Myers Holiday Inn. Guests include Instructor Captain John Dixon, Dan Kerrigan, Instructor Chris Baker, Ryan Pennington of Jump Seat Fuse, and presentations by some of the biggest names in the fire service today. That should be good enough. But one more big surprise. The fee is just $125. That's right, a buck and a quarter for as many classes as you wish to attend and admission to the banquet. Want to register? Would you like to be a sponsor? Head over to thegreatfloridafireschool.org or call 1-800-883-4817. Again, go to thegreatfloridafireschool.org or call 1-800-883-4817. The Great Florida Fire School. Be there. We want to take a moment to tell you about one of our great sponsors, the Firehouse Tribune. Firehouse Tribune is an emergency services web-based platform where individuals can learn, train, and share ideas and experiences. In life, both on and off duty, we live by one creed. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. Interested? Find them on Twitter at FH Tribune and visit their website at www.thefirehousetribune.com. Remember to always work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. The tone sound and the dispatcher announces, station 14 and 16, working residential structure, and that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams and you take stock of your PPE, bunker pants, check, turnout coat, check, hood, check, gloves, check, escape line, check, SCBA, strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the red crossley, and head for the open front door where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. You crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything. What the hell are you thinking? You see it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap of the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores of your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down that forces everyone else to change their task to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go home to. Face peace on. Welcome to another episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. I'm your host, Steve Green, and here are a couple of coming events that are happening to Dalmatian Productions and our podcast, 5 Alarm Task Force. You've probably heard us promoting the Great Florida Fire School in Fort Myers, Florida. That takes place November 8th through 12th, and we are happy to say that we will be out there. We will be doing some video and photos and doing sound bites and some interviews with some of the great guests that will be there. So look forward to segments from our time there in our December and January podcasts. We also want you to know that we're having a new website that will launch very, very soon, dalmatianproductions.tv. And you'll find everything about Dalmatian Productions,
The podcasts, our whole library of podcasts will be there, our blogs, everything you need to know about Dalmatian Productions and our project to get a good, strong television or feature film presence about the fire service, Cause Norgin. All the news you'll find right there on the new website, www.dalmatianproductions.tv. And finally, there'll be some changes to this podcast. One of the things that we're doing is shortening the number of messages in between segments and targeting those directly to first responders, more importantly than this time than at any other time. So we hope you'll continue to tune in and watch for our announcements on Twitter and on the website, www.dalmatianproductions.tv, for everything about Dalmatian Productions and this podcast, Five Alarm Task Force. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be right back with our guest, Chief Gary Ludwig, right after this. The second annual Surviving the Fire Service Conference will be held on February 27, 2018, at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Billed as a behavioral health and cancer prevention conference, the event will feature speakers including Pat Morrison, the IAFF Assistant General President for Health, Safety, and Medicine, Dr. Denise Smith, Research Scientist at IFSI, and Captain Frank Lito, Deputy Director of the FDNY Counseling Unit, who will speak about health challenges in the fire service. There will also be a panel discussion on cancer in the fire service, as well as a presentation on tragedy and loss within the fire service from a chaplain's point of view. And a portion of the fees go to help the survivors of fallen firefighters. Additional information, including registration, can be found at http://nova.edu/conference/index.html, or send an email to us, dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we will be happy to send you the link. That's the 2017-2018 Surviving the Fire Service Conference on February 27th at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale. Make your reservations today.
When you're done knocking down the flames, you want to hit the apparatus and head back to the barn, right? Wrong. If you do, you're carrying all types of poisons and carcinogens with you and spreading them wherever you go. But you can clean your gear and yourself before you even leave the scene with a Fireground Decon Kit from the folks at FireTech. This kit contains everything you need to properly and safely decontaminate yourself while still on the scene. This kit includes a pop-up pod for a private changing room, exclusive Fireground Decon hose designed to reduce contamination, all-natural decon towels, a special PPE cleaner formulated to remove stubborn hydrocarbons and that meets NFPA 1851 standard, and more. With a cancer rate among firefighters at 60% against only 20% among the general population, we can no longer ignore the dangers we can't see. For more information, visit their website at www.firegrounddeconstore.com or call FireTech at 954-906-1118.
And welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. And if you've been a member of the fire service for maybe 3 to 5 years or more, the name of our guest is going to be quite familiar to you. If you've been to any of the national convocations or regional conferences for the fire service and EMS, his name is going to be familiar to you. We're very lucky that tonight we have Chief Gary Ludwig with us as a guest. He currently serves as the fire chief for the Champaign, Illinois Fire Department. He is a well-known author and lecturer who has 40 years of fire, rescue, and EMS experience. Chief Ludwig started his career with the city of St. Louis at age 18, just 2 months out of high school, rising through the ranks and retiring as the chief paramedic of the St. Louis Fire Department after 25 years of service. He has also served 10 years as deputy fire chief for the Memphis Fire, managing their EMS system. Chief Ludwig previously served as the EMS executive board on the EMS executive board for the International Association of Fire Chiefs for 22 years, with 6 years as the chair. He is also a member of the IAFF EMS Standing Committee and has written monthly columns for Firehouse Magazine for over 20 years. He has a master's degree in business and management and has been a licensed paramedic for over 38 years. He has written over 500 articles for professional publications such as Firehouse Magazine, Fire Rescue, Fire Engineering, GEMS, and EMS World Magazine. He has also been invited to speak at over 250 professional EMS or fire conferences or seminars such as Fire Rescue International, FDIC, Firehouse Expo, EMS Today, and EMS Expo. He is the co-author of several books and is the author of Blood, Sweat, Tears, and Prayers, Firefighting in EMS in Some of the Toughest Cities in America, and Welcome to the Butterbeck School of Mismanagement, the business school that creates terrible leaders. In 2014, he was awarded the James O. Page EMS Leadership Award. Chief, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Five Alarm Task Force this evening. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. I can't tell you how much of it is of an honor for me to be on here this evening with you and discuss very relevant things that are happening in our profession.
There sure are. And this episode, to our listeners, is not going to be the same sort of training sort of stuff we touch on quite a bit. This is going to be on a topic that really affects us both as fire and EMS professionals and also as citizens. And that's because we're going to be talking about health insurance. And are we looking for health insurance reform? Or are we really looking for insurance reform and maybe reform in the entire medical billing process and how it works? And if you've had the opportunity to read this month's edition of Firehouse Magazine, Chief Ludwig had an excellent article in that issue called Healthcare Reform or Insurance Reform. The key to driving down cost is focusing on preventive rather than reactionary measures. Chief, what brought you to write this article and really take on a topic that is almost sometimes taboo, the business side of a taboo in our fields?
Well, let me just briefly say that what really piqued my interest, obviously, is that we as fire professionals were dramatically impacted by what goes on within the healthcare industry, because quite frankly, that's the majority of what we do.
Right.
As I like to say, most fire departments are really nothing but an EMS agency that sometimes goes to a fire call. Or the other thing I like to say is that we pump more oxygen than water. and the truth is we do. So we are a microcosm or a subset of the entire healthcare industry, but we're an important part of that because of the fact that we're the gatekeeper to a lot of what happens within the healthcare industry with patients going into hospitals.
Correct.
We determine that path, and we determine a lot of times that treatment and other things that are very important as far as the pathway for that patient. And so we are impacted by what goes on within the healthcare industry. And so what kind of piqued my interest in all this, quite frankly, was what happened with the Obama, what they would call the Obamacare, or the technical jargon is, you know, the healthcare of the Affordable Health Care Act that was passed by Congress and actually affirmed by the Supreme Court in a ruling.
Right.
And so, you know, if you look at that whole thing, there was 2,600 pages in there of that law, and there's been thousands and thousands of pages of regulations written on that. But of that 2,600 pages that were written in the law with the Affordable Health Care Act that was signed in by President Obama, I think there's only about a short couple paragraphs at the most that dealt with EMS. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, you know, it's amazing that we are such a pivotal and important part of the healthcare industry, and we get very little mention in the Healthcare Act. And so, you know, I came to the conclusion that, you know, they're not trying to reform healthcare. They were trying to reform insurance, mm-hmm. reform insurance on how we pay for stuff. And if they were truly interested in reforming healthcare, they would have dealt with the healthcare industry and looked to see what was best way to deliver healthcare. And so now we see that Obamacare is failing in many communities and many states. And the Republicans now are trying to pass an alternative with this repeal and replace and they can't seem to get it done. And they're not arguing and debating about so much health care as much as they are, how are we going to pay for this? And it's what I call, you know, insurance reform, not health care reform, it's insurance reform.
Right.
And so, and the other thing I just find ironic about it, Steve, is that we have a bunch of people in Washington, D.C. who have never been in the health care business, and they're the ones that are actually enacting the law to change it. And it just, none of it makes any sense to me. And so that's the basis and the genesis of the article that I wrote this month in Firehouse Magazine.
Well, you hit upon probably, as you mentioned, a key issue, because all in all, as we deliver our service, normally those of us in the field don't really think about the business side of the operation. We check our rigs out in the morning, we make sure we have all our equipment, and we wait for that first alarm to come in, and we respond and do what we have to do to service the citizens of our communities. And we leave the business side of it to the quote-unquote, the geeks in the office to do the billing and collections, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's something that we miss. And over the years, and I've been reading your articles for many years in Firehouse Magazine, when I was in active service and then since I've been out. And I think the whole atmosphere has changed because I worked with EMS in Guilford County, North Carolina for just under a year, just part-time. And very rarely did we even hear anything about the billing situation or how we handle the patients regarding the delivery of our medical care as it related to billing and prices. And now it's exploded to, as you said, it's almost the business of fire and EMS today is knowing what prices, what that business side of the ledger is going to be and how it's going to affect the jobs that we do. And the question is there a way to get the people in Washington to listen to those of us who provide a great part of the service, as you said, that we were only a tiny, tiny percentage point, if that, of the actual bill itself when it first came out.
Absolutely. And you bring out some excellent points, and you're absolutely right. Why would the average firefighter, paramedic in the street want to worry about the insurance and the health care reform? Is it insurance reform? All that sort of stuff. Well, it is. It is something that they don't have to worry about. Did we collect everything we could have? You know, did we dot the I and cross the T's to make sure we get maximum reimbursement? You know, we like to see that, but we know that they're more concerned about patient care. But the reality is that they are indirectly affected by this, because if we were truly reformed health care, we would change this whole paradigm of you call 911 regardless of what is the nature of the complaint, and we send an ambulance, we take you, we get to the scene, we ask you what's wrong, you want to go to the hospital, we put you in the back of an ambulance and we take you to the hospital and we take you to the emergency room, and it could be something of low acuity. I have horrendous stories in my time where when I was in St. Louis working, I'll never get a call at 4 a.m. where we went on a guy who had chest pain for 17 years, and then it stopped one night, and that's when he got worried and called 911. And I have, you know, I can tell you a litany of different stories. I'm sure our listeners can also, they've all gone on these calls. And so does it make sense to send two professionals out there, two firefighter paramedics, and a very expensive vehicle to a scene for someone that is having a low acuity, non-emergency, you know, it's been bothering me for 6 weeks sort of event, and then we transport them to one of the highest forms of, most expensive forms of delivering care, and that is the emergency room, for something of low acuity. Mm-hmm. And so if they were truly looking at reforming healthcare, we would look at this whole model and say, well, how do we deliver healthcare, and how can we do it better and more efficiently? And how can we use our resources better? Is it because it's not very resourceful, and it's not very useful, and it's not very efficient to take that expensive vehicle and roll it down the street for someone who's had, you know, a fever for 3 days and they've run out of their medication. And so it's time for them to go back in the emergency room and get some medication refilled. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm sure, Steve, that you've gone on those calls during your time period, and it's just something that is not an efficient use of it. But guess what? If you take them to the emergency room and you can document the necessity for it, your ambulance service gets reimbursed for that. So does that make any sense? None of that makes any sense. And so that's why we need to reform healthcare as opposed to reforming insurance, and that way, the way we pay for our healthcare.
So with that in mind, can the members of now we know we have the great Congressional Fire Caucus that helps speak for the fire service in general, which would include the firefighter paramedics. And also we have to remember, not only do we often run that ambulance to that call, but we oftentimes send an engine or a truck company as additional team members. So we're taking...
Yes.
You know, we're taking both vehicles out of service and two crews, as you said, for possibly a fever that's 3 days old and is not acute and not emergent in its nature. So while we have the Congressional Fire Caucus for that, do they address any of those concerns from the fire service as trying to get to our members in Congress the importance of maybe making the changes? And I think another factor just really came to mind. Before the, probably over the last 10 years, since we've had the explosion of walk-in med centers, I think a lot of this traffic was also driven because people who didn't have insurance decided, or didn't have their own private doctor, decided to use the emergency room as their primary care physician. And the only way to do that was they called 911. And so
Absolutely. We
started going out on all those calls, and Billy stubbed his toe. And next thing you know, we're tied up for 45 minutes taking this kid and his parent to the emergency room and waiting till we get released and they sign the releases, paperwork, et cetera, et cetera. Who knows what else we may have missed. It reminds me of an old episode of Emergency, which I know was very important to get me into the business. Where Roy and Johnny were upset that sometimes one of the doctors was having them start an IV on a patient that really wasn't emergent in their evaluation, because it required them then to do a complete follow-up, spend more time at the hospital, and probably, I believe it mentioned, increased costs for the patient. And that show was on 30-some-odd years ago, and yet here we are debating almost the very same situation today.
It is, it is ironic. I think we're more than 30 years, because I've been doing this 40 years, and I remember watching that as a young teenager. And like you, and like a lot of your listeners, we probably, that was kind of the impetus for us getting involved in this profession.
Absolutely.
But you're right, and exactly what you say, and that is that a couple points you made that are exactly right on, and that is, well, number one, you're right, that I talked about the engine rolling down the street, but they're right, you're right. In many cases, there's an engine rolling down the street also on these types of calls. And so one of the things that I will applaud the fire service for is that we find solutions.
Right.
We find solutions. And so one of the things that we're starting to really, truly emerge and see here with the advent of the Affordable Care Act is this emergence of this mobile integrated healthcare model that EMS systems are starting to embrace. And as best I can find, there's about 300 systems around the country that are actually, most of those are fire-based EMS systems, by the way, that are using what I would call a mobile integrated healthcare. Some people use the word community paramedic type of program. But it's an alternative to what we're doing, and they're trying to combat this growing 911 call volume, the amount of money that insurance companies try to tighten down and not pay us, and then also the people who are not you know, who are using 911 systems for inappropriate use. So what you're seeing is this emergence and these different types of models for dealing with these low acuity patients. And I categorize them into three categories, Steve. You got the ones, there are three different types of programs out there, even though there's different hybrids. But the first one is where the 911 caller calls 911, and somewhere at the 911 center, they're screening that call and saying, nope, you don't need an ambulance. We're gonna send you some other type of vehicle, or we're gonna pathway you into a some other type of resource, or we're gonna also set you up for a clinic appointment.
Okay.
You know, you look at the Fort Worth system, they're actually screening those calls with the nurse. And the nurse is lining them up for I think it's an Uber or I think it's a Lyft car that's being sent to the person's house to take them to the hospital instead of an ambulance.
Wow.
So you look at the Houston system, the Houston Fire Department, they actually have a doctor in their communication center. And the hybrid off of that, very similar to what I just described, is that the crew gets to the scene, determines the low acuity. They actually use their tablet or their toughbook, which has a video capability on it, and they call into the doctor who is in the communication center, and the doctor can look at the patient and communicate directly with the patient. And the medics will then also relay the information to the doctor, such as what the vital signs were, the blood pressure, the pulse, any other history they found, any other assessment things that they found. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor talks directly to the patient and says, you know, I don't think you need to go to the emergency room. And he has two computer screens in front of him. One, you know, he's pulling up what is the closest clinic to this person and right. What are the appointment hours that are available. And the second screen he's got is to the local cab company. So he's making an appointment, and the next thing you know, he's switching over and contacting the cab company and sending a cab to the house instead of having those medics take that patient to the emergency room. Now, they have some different models there. For instance, the patient is insistent on going to the emergency room, they still take them.
Right.
But they may take them by cab. But so you have that model. And you have some other models out there where you have in Louisville, Kentucky, as an example, where, again, you have nurses in the 911 center who are screening calls. And that's just one. So I said there's three different forms of this mobile integrated healthcare. So that's one where you're screening calls at the 911 center and determine the patient doesn't need to use an ambulance or and or even an emergency room. The second one model is where they're actually sending some type of vehicle out to the scene. Most of them are either a PA or a nurse practitioner in the vehicle, along with a firefighter paramedic. And their goal is to treat and release the patient at the scene. And even you look at Mesa, Arizona, not only do they have that, but they also now have a psychiatric or a psychological counselor in the car with a firefighter paramedic. That's their other type of system. So they have two. They have the medical side, and they have the psychiatric side, behavioral medicine side. And that car is designed to deal with people who are having behavioral problems or psychiatric problems, or they've run out of their meds, that sort of stuff. And so you have that type of situation. And then you also have another form of this model, like they're doing in Prince William County, Virginia, where they're identifying, or is it Prince George's? I always get the two princes mixed up, where they are basically identifying the frequent users, or as we sometimes in our profession call them, our loyalty customers, where they are contacting these people and contacting them saying, what's the problem? Why are you calling 911? They go out to the house, they assess what their needs are. So you have I think it's either a nurse practitioner or a PA working with the patient on finding out what their needs and what can they do to keep them from calling 911 medically. And then all while they're there, the firefighter paramedic is also doing the home assessment and looking for smoke alarms and CO alarms, fall hazard opportunities. Are they not eating right? I know they're segueing them into the Meals on Wheels programs for senior citizens, that type of program. And then the third part, the models that I've seen out there, so we got pre-screening 911, on-scene care, and then the third one I've seen is mobile integrated healthcare, is after hospital care, where hospitals are partnering with fire departments, and when a patient is discharged from the hospital, they're getting follow-up care from paramedics within that fire department who are coming to their home, making sure all their needs are taken care of, making sure they're compliant with their medicines, with the goal of preventing readmission back to the hospital. So we as a fire service, as I said, I'm going on and on with these explanations, but we have a tendency to find solutions. We are problem solvers. And so we recognize these issues, that this is not the best model to use for these low acuity patients. So what are we going to do about it? And now you've seen this emergence of this mobile integrated healthcare, or these community paramedics, whatever term you want to use. That's what we're starting to see emerge out there, to deal with this reform of how we deliver care within the field.
Well, I know I've actually seen it. It just started taking place in my own community here in Northwest Broward County of South Florida. They took a retired rescue truck and decked it out, kept the lights and sirens, but they put it in a nice blue and white coloring, and it's a mobile medical office, they're calling it. You can call for either an appointment for them to come to you, or if it's semi-urgent, you can make a call and they'll come to your home or your business. Check it out. I believe there's a nurse practitioner on board, or a paramedic or a PA. And the word I've heard so far is that it's been working fairly well. Now, there's only one of them right now in this our community of over 125,000 people. But, you know, it's a start. And from the locations that you've given, we see some of the major fire departments and EMS delivery services, you know, taking this step, as you said, to solve the problem that nobody else is looking at as a problem that we have to face. Because, again, we don't deal with that money aspect. We have to deal with the service aspect. And in our business, we cannot deny service. It's as simple as
absolutely
that. You know, there's no denial of service in this business without, you know, heavy, heavy and often sad consequences. So we're going to take a break at this point, Chief. And when we come back, you had one of the sections of your article talked about the right people. So when we come back, let's discuss that section of the article, and who do you consider the right people for us to look towards to make the changes that are so desperately needed in this field and in insurance reform, healthcare reform, so that we can provide the citizens of our communities good health care without overtaxing both the fire EMS services and the emergency room, so that they don't get filled up with non-emergent people and have to turn away real emergency situations. So we'll be right back right after these words, folks. Please stay tuned. No matter where we live, or no matter the season, there is always work to be done that makes us sweat. Just how can we keep cool? Well, Hennessy Distributing has the answer. Cool towels. Cool towels are 100% cotton towel and pre-moistened with all natural ingredients. The best part? No water is needed. Just open your cool towel pack, remove the towel and give it a couple of shakes, and you're all set. Wrap it around your neck like a kerchief, wipe your face, arms, neck, or any exposed skin, and it is approximately 20 to 30 degrees below the ambient temperature. Wait, did it warm up? No problem. Just shake it a couple of times again, and Cool Towel delivers its refreshing cool touch all over again. When the cooling mixture has expired, use your cool towel as you would any cloth or rag around the house. Because it is manufactured from 100% cotton, your cool towel is 100% recyclable. For more information or to get your cool towel today, visit www.cooltowel.com or call 1-800-918-8323. Remember, you're going to work and you're going to sweat. Make Cool Towel your answer to keeping cool.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
And welcome back to our second segment here on Five Alarm Task Force News and Issues for today's first responders. And our guest tonight is Chief Gary Ludwig, very well experienced in both fire and EMS. And we're talking about the problems that we're having across the country and in government, and whether we're looking at really healthcare and reform, or do we need insurance reform? And we're going to start off this segment talking about the right people, but we talked a couple of moments off air, and we decided to start off with we have some right people representing us in Washington doing the best they can, but they're up against the wrong people. And you mentioned three particular groups that our representatives have to battle, so to speak, in trying to get the word across of what needs to be done to help the fire and EMS people in the field and help American citizens themselves with their own health care itself. Will you address those issues, please, Chief?
Sure. We have the IAFC, the International Association of Fire Chiefs, the IAFF, the International Association of Firefighters. We all have lobbyists up in Washington, D.C., and we do, both organizations do the best they can to promote the interests of the fire services. And, you know, we talk about, you know, insurance reform and healthcare reform. Well, not only are they up there also, dealing with those issues, but they're also up there, you know, working on other legislation such as sprinkler bills and the SAFER grant and, AFG grants and just a variety of different things. And so, so they got their hands full. That's just, healthcare reform is just not the only thing that our lobbyists up there are dealing with. And so, you got to remember that they're not the only people up on Capitol Hill, the lobbyists from the IAFC and the IFF. You know, the insurance lobby has a ton of people up there, and they have a ton of money that they're able to dump into lobbying efforts. The hospital industry, other healthcare industries, they have a ton of money that they can also dump into it. And if you don't think the lawyers are involved in this, oh, think again, because the lawyers are definitely involved in this. They want to make sure that there's no caps that are put on all this when it comes to any type of tort reform.
Right.
They want to make sure that they're not being limited in damages to $100,000. You know, they would like to have those settlements that are worth $5, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 million. Mm-hmm. So you would not believe the amount of people who are involved in lobbying our Congress in trying to see, you know, what legislation they can get that's favorable to them. I'll never forget after 9/11. You know, all the money that became available for first responders to prepare and get us, you know, up to where we should be at as far as responding to a terrorist event. Everybody and their brother became a first responder, Steve. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
We had veterinarians who thought they were first responders, and we thought, the home healthcare nurses, they were trying to tap into that federal money. They were first responders. Everybody and their brother was classifying themselves as a first responder, and so my point being is that Congress is constantly bombarded by all these different special interests. And so here you have these two organizations, the IAFC and the IFF, doing the best they can with our lobbyists up on Capitol Hill, you know, to make sure they represent not only our interest in health care reform, but also all the other issues that impact our profession.
Right.
So there are the wrong people up there that are working against us on some of these issues.
And are much more powerful than our people are as well, and a lot more money behind them to do it.
Oh, can you imagine how much money the lawyers and the hospitals and the insurance industry has that they put into lobbying efforts with our Congress people up on Capitol Hill, it must be phenomenal.
You know, I remember after I had my first back surgery in 1992, I got the bill, and I've always been this way. I'm not quite sure. Maybe it's because of my experience in the industry. But I looked over the hospital bill item by item. I had to ask for an itemized bill before I could get it. And that was when I had my first wake-up call to the $25 Tylenol pill, or the video on how to walk with crutches, even though I'd had knee surgery four times by that time and several sprained ankles. And additionally, that no one ever came to my room with a video. It wasn't on a channel on their television system. There was nothing there, but there was a $175 charge for it on that bill. So I took a highlighter, and I went through everything that I could tell was not pertinent to my care. And I was only there overnight. And I called the hospital, and I said, listen, when I got home, a couple of days later, I called them, and I said, listen, I've gone over the bill, and I have about $11,000 of charges that are, you know, not correct. Well, whatever, you know, they're always correct, Mr. Green. I said, no, they're not always correct. I said, you know, this one for video, line such and such. Nobody ever came to my room, and nobody needed to, but nobody came to my room with a video. Nothing at all. They had to be there. You were probably asleep. I said, then why would they show a video to a patient who was asleep? Hello, are you still there, ma'am?
Sense.
Yeah, ma'am, are you still there? I'm here, yeah. I said, so that's just one. That was $175, and that's just one of almost $11,000. I said, so you can go ahead and charge those, but I'm going to send a copy of my copy to my insurance company so they'll know all the charges that I dispute. So you make up your mind which one you want to send to them, but I'm sending them mine. And sure enough, when I got the EOB back from the insurance company, almost every single one of those charges had been removed from it. And that was 1992. Here we are, 2017, 25 years later, and it's even worse than that. We know that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm an avid reader of books, and one of the books I read that just pretty much epitomizes what you're talking about, and that is, it's called Catastrophic Healthcare. And it's written by a man that had nothing to do with the healthcare industry whatsoever. And what happened was, his father went into the hospital, came down with a staph infection. And one of the things that happened then was, I guess about 2 weeks later, he died. I think it was about 2 weeks died. Mm-hmm. And, or 2 weeks later, he died. And so he got a bill in the mail, like what you just described. And the bill was for $600,000. And he goes, holy cow. So just as an experiment, he decided what he would do is he would go and see what would it take for him to rent out the presidential suite at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. Wow. And then what would it cost that for a lot of those same items that were on that bill for a hospital bed for 2 weeks, or the nursing care, the doctors, the medicine, the food, everything that it would take, and the same type of care and everything he got in the hospital, the medicines, everything. And when he added that up, Even with him having the suite, the presidential suite at the Waldorf Astoria, that bill was only $300,000 compared to the $600,000 bill that he got for his father at the hospital. And so this book pretty much details, you know, an interesting concept of our healthcare system. And I never thought about it until I read the book, and that is that, Steve, when you went out and bought your car, you know, you just didn't go up and say, hey, I want that one, and not ask what it cost.
Correct.
When you went and bought, you went out and shopped around.
Yes,
you looked
I did.
And saw what was the best deal for the best dollar. You know, when you bought a microwave or a lawnmower or a blow dryer or whatever, you know, you looked around. You might even did some research on the internet looking to see what the consumer reports were on something.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how we buy our health care that we pay for. we just go in and say, hey, I'm here, and we never ask what it costs. We never ask what is the impact of the services that are being delivered. You know, when they say, I'm going to give you, you know, I'm going to do something for you, we don't ask, what does that cost? We just assume our insurance company is going to take care of it. And so the healthcare providers, they keep upping the prices. And so the insurance companies, they keep upping the premiums on us and our employers to pay for these prices from the suppliers, such as hospitals and doctors and nurses and other types of suppliers and providers. And so in 1992, what we see is this continual evolutionary cycle of raising prices because there's nothing competitive about it. And I'll tell you a quick story. He talks about his sister-in-law who came from Russia and came to America and got hurt, had no health care insurance here, and went to the doctor. And he said, I want you to have an MRI on this leg. So, well, they did what I just talked about. They asked questions. Well, they went to the hospital there and asked, what does an MRI cost? And they said, $1,500. So, okay, well, they got out the phone book and called other MRI places. And, well, how much does your MRI cost? Well, this one's $800. So they called somebody else, $500. They, you know, it's $500 over here. They called somebody else. What does this cost? $300. Finally, they got down to, they got some guy at some place who could do the MRI on a Saturday if they came in at the end of the day for $200.
Wowee.
So what they did was they shopped around. They shopped around for the best price, you know, and told people, hey, I can get it for this over here. What would it cost me over here? And so he and his theory in this book is that is wrong with our, that's what's wrong with our healthcare system. There's nothing competitive about it. I will tell you, I had some healthcare work done a couple of years ago and a certain procedure. And then, oh my God, I went and looked at the hospitals online to the state of Illinois where I live at. They grade the hospitals in all these different categories. And I went online and looked. I'm like, oh my God, you know, they had a grade of C and D in these different departments. And, you know, based on mortality rates and other types of things that were coming out of this department, this particular service out of this particular hospital. Then I checked the other hospital across town and they all had categories of A's, you know, a grade of A. And I'm like, well, shoot, I should have checked this out before I went and had the procedure done at this one hospital.
Right.
I didn't shop around. Not only did I not look at the price, but I didn't look at the quality of care that they're delivering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so not only do we look at, we should be looking at price maybe, but also the quality of care. And so we don't ask those questions. We don't ask, what is the quality of care delivered at this facility? And we don't ask, what does this cost? And so his whole concept, his whole premise of the book was, that is what's wrong with our healthcare system as far as financially goes, is there's no incentivization to provide a good price at a good quality cost. The only thing they're incentivized is to do good because they might get sued by a lawyer. So it's a really interesting book and written by, I'll have to look up the name of the gentleman who wrote the book, but it was an interesting book for me to read. And every so often I'll go back and read it again just to kind of refresh myself.
Yeah, I'm going to, I'll just look up by title on Amazon. I'm sure I'll find it. There was a point you just made when you were talking about that I think that there's a snowball effect in the industry. Having worked as the office manager for a physician's office for 9 years, which meant that I was in charge of making sure all the claims went out. First, we still did them on paper on the HCFA 1500 forms before we moved to all electronic billing. But it was often interesting to see how many of the companies would delay payment on claims. And I'm not talking about 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. We went 6 months. I tried following up, never got responses. Once in a while, we'd get a check. So I spoke with our legal counsel, and I said, there's got to be something that can help us with both the filing and when they have to pay the office. Well, he found in West's law, he found for the state of Florida
that, number one, whatever date is computerized on the claim, even if it was printed off the computer in the office, is considered the mail date in the state of Florida, that it was mailed within 24 hours of that printing, number one. Number two, that for a non-workers' comp or automobile injury claim, that they had to, the insurance companies that did business, not, they didn't have to be housed here, but as long as they sold policies in the state of Florida, they had to reply with either a payment or denial within 45 days. After that, there was a 10% simple net trust that could be compounded on their balance. So all I did was print up the copy of the citation from West, and in my follow-up letters, I put that copy, and I sent the certified mail return receipt requested, and the money started coming in. And because they didn't want to pay, you know, most of them didn't even realize that the simple interest wouldn't be that much. But when we had claims that we were waiting on $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to that company, that's then it starts accruing for them. And of course, what a lot of people don't know is how they play with their money, the insurance companies. They keep them all the major funds in investments and in special accounts, and then they transfer only what they need on a given day into that checking account to pay those bills for that day and keep the rest aside. That's why we have to wait forever for these payments to be made. And what you talked about their lobby, and when we talked about a moment ago the $25 Tylenol pill, there's also the retort that has come back many times. I'm sure many people have heard it, that why is the price so high for that? Why is the price, you know, I can get, let's go back to the Tylenol. I can get a box, a package of 40 Tylenol pills for under $10. And you want me to pay $25 for a single Tylenol capsule. Well, we have to collect enough money to pay for those who don't have money to pay for themselves. Well, the fact is that money is supposed to come from the state. So it's, to me, it's double dipping. They want to make sure that they get it one way or another, just to, so they bump up these costs. I'm sure with the volume discounts that people like to see in catalog stores and big box stores, love to see volume discounts. I'm sure you can bet your bottom dollar that the hospitals in your community buy Tylenol pills and other over-the-counter medications getting volume discounts. And as you said before, it's part of their way of doing business. And that's, and
right,
until we break that cycle, until we're able to at least put a nick in it, maybe we can't break it right away, but until we can punch and make a dent in it, that's going to continue to happen, because they think that everybody is accepting of it, because very few people come back and bemoan their pricing. And as you said, you know, I mean, when we go into a restaurant in many cities, right on that front window or the front door, we're looking for the sanitation grade for that restaurant. Is it an A or B, or has it been closed in the past 4 weeks because of rodent droppings and cockroaches? And we say, well, I'm not stepping in that door. But the same thing happens in many of the hospitals, not from willful negligence, but from simply getting the amount of maintenance gets away from the number of people working in it, and they don't pay a lot of attention to it. And so that happens not just in the maintenance department, but it works its way up to every professional level until you're at the caregivers themselves. And, you know, it's a tough, tough, not a hill anymore. It's a tough, tough mountain for us to climb. And we have to make sure that we let our representatives from our fire organizations, EMS organizations, let them know that we're behind the work that they're doing. And to let them know that we're willing to be a voice if they need it, tell us where and when. So, you know, we do our staircase climbs every year, at least once a year, in most communities for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to raise funds for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and to remember our 343 brothers we lost on 9/11. And we have to remember our other brothers and sisters from the Port Authority and the Police Department of New York who lost their lives doing those same jobs, trying to rescue innocent people from that terrorist attack. And we have to let our representatives know that we're behind them and we back them up 1,000%. And so, folks, if you haven't really thought about doing that, that might be a good place for you to start. Find out who the representatives are on the Congressional Fire Institute and the caucus, and drop them a line and tell them that you appreciate everything they're doing to try to straighten things out for us. And as the chief just said, though, healthcare reform and insurance reform is just one blip on the radar that they have to take care of, especially with the grants coming up for a possible permanent cancellation in the very, very near future. So they have to right now be focusing on making sure we can get those grants out to the deserving departments.
Want to tell you briefly, I looked up that book. It's called Catastrophic Care by a man by the name of David Goldhill. Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It.
Great. All right. Well, if you didn't catch the title, drop us a line at dalmatprod@outlook.com. We'll make sure we'll have it for you and pass it on for your edification. You also made a very good point, two of them here, that really stood out that I highlighted. First was, does it make sense that people who cannot pay the most expensive transportation method to an ER, where they will receive the most expensive treatment possible for a minor ailment? And the answer for that has to be no.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. It's ridiculous. Again, we're, you know, they're trying to reform insurance and how we pay for it, but they're not looking at health care. And so that's just one, or how we do health care. That's just one example of the whole equation. You know, is that, and we're impacted by that because it's people. And even though everybody's supposed to have insurance, we know that that's not always true. But, you know, under Obamacare, everybody was supposed to get insurance or else you'd be penalized. Well, there's a lot of people still running around with no insurance. And so so what do? They call 911. They're relying on government services. And they know that they can be transported to the emergency room. Well, they'll be cared for because under the Impella Act, which is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, they're treated in the hospital and without, you know, doing a wall biopsy to see if they can pay or not. Now, if that same person were to call a doctor and try to schedule an appointment, the first thing they're asked is, what insurance do you have? Well, I don't have any. Well, I'm sorry, we can't see you. And so the same thing is applicable here where, you know, that wallet screening occurs when you try to call and make an appointment with the doctor. They want to make sure you have insurance that you can pay for it. For the most part, that's how most doctors operate, and you can't blame them because they got a business they have to run.
Exactly.
And, you know, they got overhead, they got staff they have to pay. I'm not belittling them, but so what happens is that there's this safety net of the fire service, and they call 911. We respond, and we take you to the emergency room, which you just so succinctly said is the most expensive way of delivering health care. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Exactly. And
then, you know, here's the bad part too, sure. Steve. You know, we're talking about finance reform. The only way that an ambulance ever gets reimbursed, a service gets reimbursed, is if you transport to an emergency room. We've been trying to work with Medicare and other private insurance companies, insurance lobbies say, it is cheaper if you let us treat and release and pay us. It's cheaper if you let us you know, take them to a clinic instead of transporting them to the emergency room. Pay us to do that instead of paying them to take them to the emergency room. We can't get these people to listen at HHS about this, at the Health and Human Services.
Right.
It's ridiculous. We can do all kinds of programs as healthcare providers in the field, but they don't want to pay us to do that. So we're virtually forced to take them to the hospitals to get reimbursed in an ambulance. And so all these programs that I talked about with mobile integrated healthcare, sometimes, you know, those services are eating those costs to do that. But I am an advocate that if you're going to do that, work with your local hospital systems, work with your local accountable care organizations, and try to get some money back in your system. Just don't do that for free, because the hospitals are making money off that. If you can divert them from the hospital and treat and release, the accountable care organizations are making money off of that. You need to partner with them and see that you can get some of that money back into your system to pay for your services and maybe hire some new people and some more people.
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. We're going to take another break here. And when we come back, I'm going to bring up the other very important point that I found in the chief's article in the October edition of Firehouse Magazine. And it's a fact. It's going to be a medical fact that comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You might find it interesting, and it really hits the nail on the head with what the chief is talking about of who needs care, where, and when. And we'll talk about that when we come back right after these words. Stay tuned.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property. And you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back with our third segment for Five Alarm Task Force News and Issues for today's first responders. And we're talking about something that is unique to our shows, because we've never addressed the concept of health care insurance or personal insurance and what's going on in Washington trying to reform insurance. And luckily, our guest, Chief Gary Ludwig, wrote a magnificent article in Firehouse in the October edition. If you're not a subscriber, which you should be, and then go to a Firehouse or find a way of picking it, finding it on its digital form. But you need to read this article so that you can learn all what's happening behind the curtain. You know, in The Wizard of Oz, the voice comes out and says, forget the man behind the curtain, he's nothing. But he was controlling all the lights and all the strings from back there. We can no longer afford to disregard the man behind the curtain and the woman behind the curtain. If this problem is going to be solved, our problem of delivering the services in a properly triaged way, we go on an MCI call, we know there's going to be a triage section set up. Well, even for these phone call dispatchers, as the chief told us, some of the municipalities in the country are working on that by putting either a physician or nurse practitioner in the communications room and helping to with an overview of the patient that they can give to a doctor, or they can actually connect with the doctor electronically through a pad device. And then he or she could see the patient, look them over, go over the vitals with them, and decide there. But the article comes from Firehouse, and it reads like this. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 7 out of 10 deaths are attributed to a chronic disease. How many early deaths or healthcare costs could be eliminated by catching a disease early? How many hospital stays could be eliminated? How many heart attacks could be caught with a routine screening? I know several firefighters who underwent a stress test with their yearly physicals, and widowmaker blockages were caught before the unthinkable happened. A simple stent placed, and they were back to work on the job. And this is so true because this is the very heart, pardon the pun, of our health and wellness and cancer initiatives in the fire service today, is that very issue. We're trying to catch these preventable issues before they do irreconcilable damages. And we know, sadly, from the facts and figures of the monthly or every 6 week lists of line of duty deaths that the magazines publish, we see we're losing too many of our young men and women to preventable health issues. That doesn't safeguard you all the way around. We all know the crap happens and it can't be avoided. But how do we, Chief, kind of, again, work this observation that you made in the article about the CDC's finding? Departments are doing it for their own people. And you were able to quote one right there. So how do we get that word out, not just to, again, the people in the fire service, but to the citizens at large, that there is cheaper and affordable preventable screenings available to you if you ask for it?
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt there, but yeah, you're right. It's frustrating to me to know that we can prevent a lot of different things if we just catch it early on. And I've asked this question, why don't the insurance companies want to pay for these sort of things? Why don't they want to do these sort of things? And, I'm certainly not a communist. I'm a capitalist. I believe in our free society and, our economic system. I'm a strong patriot. But one of the things I've been told, the reason why they don't advocate for these things, is that insurance companies will pay for, say, for you to have a stress test. They would pay annually for you to have a stress test. They know at some point you're not going to be their client anymore. That you're going to probably, because of your employer, you're going to move on to somebody else.
Right.
And so the thinking is, should we pay for this if somebody else is, some other insurance company is going to benefit down the line because we caught something and fixed it and then they're benefiting from it? Because, employers, they're apt to switch insurance companies, often based on the best deal they can get.
Oh, absolutely.
So I've been told, and I haven't had this confirmed, but I've had several people tell me this already, that insurance companies are not apt to want to have preventive programs because, not to be repetitive, but again, they don't reap rewards from that. Some other insurance company will reap the reward from that because you'll be eventually moving on through your employer to some other insurance company. And I'm like, oh my gosh, really? I mean, imagine, if we thought that way in the fire service, well, we're not going to have our physicals done on our firefighters because we know that you may go and become a firefighter at some other fire department, so why should they benefit from us doing physicals on you? That's the logic of that. It doesn't make any logic whatsoever, quite frankly. But it's important that we do preventive stuff. If you look at some of the things I talk about in the article, there are some interesting things there, such as what is the life expectancy? What has the life expectancy been like over the last 100 years or so?
Right.
And if you look at if you were a male in 1850, yes, I would have been dead by now. It was 38 years. By 1890, just the turn of the century, 1900, it was 42. The average life expectancy was 42. And so I would have been dead there, chances are. 1910, it was 50. So about 100 years ago, the average life expectancy, if you were a male, was age 50. Today, for a male, it's 78, almost 79 years, 78.94 years. So it's almost 79 years. I'm like, and females are even better than that. But what has happened over the years, as things have come in place, such as antibiotics and vaccines, our soldiers actually back in the Civil War never had antibiotics. And so if you look at vaccines and all the different other advances that have been made in medicine, mm-hmm. It has actually prolonged our life expectancy. there are all kinds of theorists in the future that will say in the future that we'll live, our future generations will live to be 125 and 150 years of age because of several things. One, we've already genomically mapped the body, or genetically mapped the body through the Genome Project. We know all the DNA of our body. And if you look at it, there's about 2,800 diseases that are caused by some type of hereditary factor or something within your DNA, including heart disease. If your dad had heart disease, good chance you're going to have heart disease.
Right.
You know, if you got cancer that runs in your family, you're going to have a good chance you're going to have cancer. You know, if you had high blood pressure, your mom or dad had high blood pressure, good chance you'll have high blood pressure.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these things are genetic. If we were to go in and manipulate the genes, which again, they're studying right now on how to do this through gene therapy and all the different things that are going on with immunotherapies right now, again, through biotech type of stuff, you can see where we might live to be 125 or 150 years of age at some point, and especially if they can identify the gene and how to manipulate the gene that ages us, the biological clock, if they can slow that down. So, you know, we've gone from in 1850 to living to be 38 years of age to a little over 100 years later, maybe close to 200 years later, and we can be living to be 125 and 150 years of age. So I've had people tell me, hey, I don't want to live that long. So, but I'm sure there are some people that wouldn't mind. As long as you have quality of life, why would you not want to live that long?
Well, so, you just have to take the keys.
But it's all through this preventive thing. Even the gene manipulation will be preventive. It will be preventive from letting the disease to go through its process.
Right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to say, you know, when you talked about the age, I was going to, people wanting to live to the age, you just have to be careful they don't crash their flying cars at their advanced
That's
age.
That's right.
You know?
Well, chances are your car will be driving you. You won't be driving your car anymore.
You're right.
You'll have autonomous driving vehicles. So
yeah, I actually saw the prototype for one that's in Europe right now fly just a couple of weeks ago. And again, as the reporter said, I'm not quite sure how many people are going to be ready to walk into or take a seat on a jet that doesn't have any humans controlling it whatsoever. And it's a good point, but I think that, you know, preventive medicine is now at the forefront of the fire service, because we've had so many losses that we know that anywhere in the yearly period, no matter what the total number is, we're looking still around 50 to 60% or a little bit more are due to preventable health issues. And we have great people out in the fire service. You know, I think off the top of my bat, Dan Kerrigan and Jim Moss, who do firefighter fitness. They do their conferences. They have videos and CDs for you to purchase. And there are many others, because we are now finding out only in the last few years just how sick we really are from the job we love to do. But we have ways around it, because if you can participate at some level, just a start, if it has to be, just some starting level, every bit you do to reduce your contamination from when you're on a working job, on your gloves, on your helmet, on your turnout gear, on your boots, every ounce of effort you put into doing so is a positive effort towards improving your health. And that can't be
absolutely
pushed aside. We thought initially that it was all our brave comrades who walked that pile for days on end trying to bring back that which would give closure to so many families. And all they were told was, don't worry about the air, just wear those masks and you'll be fine. We have two different definitions of the word fine. There's the one that's mm-hmm. in the dictionary, and there's the one that Washington decided to use. And unfortunately, their form has killed a good number of our, again, brave brothers and sisters with weird forms of cancers from the chemicals and the minerals and the metals they were inhaling from that fire. And we see it more and more in the materials we handle every day. And so healthcare could very well just, besides taking care of you and your wife and your kids, healthcare is reaching out with a vine, those ever-growing vines from Jumanji movie that grasp onto you and won't let go of you. They bite into you because our job is risky. And as we said before, we learn how to mitigate risks, as many as we can. In EMS, of course, we started with gloves and masks. Then we started with other devices and products as well. And it's expanded. And we have face shields now. We have sleeves, artificial sleeves to wear, stuff like that. But we must understand that our health is tied to the task of those representing us, because we're caught up in that same health reform. I'm on Medicare now. I've been on Medicare before age 65 due to my disabling injury. But the fact is that the supplementary still is out of pocket. Part of Medicare is out of pocket, especially those charges they won't approve, but have to be paid at some point. And even though Medicare was designed to be this really good dreamland catch-all, now we don't know if our children, and I have daughters 34 and 32, I don't know if they're going to see any Medicare when they get ready to retire. And just think how much money the government might still have in a working budget if we were able to cut down these health care costs.
Oh, I agree. I mean, if you look at it, our national debt is $20 trillion now. It doubled just in the last, 8 years under the Obama administration. And, went from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. And I don't know what type of legacy we're leaving. And I'm not blaming Obama. I'm just saying the members of Congress are a part of that, too. All our representatives in Washington are a part of that. And so when you have that type of debt and you're paying interest on that type of debt, at some point there's a tipping point and you have to take away from the Medicare fund, Social Security, and all these other things. And you're right. At some point, where does it stop at? And so I worry about my grandchildren also. You worry about your children. I worry about my grandchildren. You know, what type of world are we leaving them that they're going to have to mess to clean up here? And at what point do we economically implode on ourselves because of this? And, at some point, other people, other nations will stop having to buy our bonds because it doesn't make any sense for them to buy our bonds. And
right.
I know that the American dollar, and I'm off an economic, tirade right now, but the economic, we still have a good, strong American dollar, and that's a lot of countries around the world want to buy our bonds and invest in our country. But at some point, it's going to look ridiculous to do so because if the debt gets that high, and there can be nothing left to pay on that interest. So anyway, I went off on an economic tirade, but you're absolutely right on what you're saying about the future for our children. Absolutely. But I'll bring this back around. And prevention will certainly help some of these healthcare costs that you just spoke about. In my opinion, prevention will help definitely.
Well, then that's what we have to aim for. And again, we may not knock the whole wall down right away, but we can start doing what we can to chip away until we get that first hole. And Chief, I want to really thank you for spending time. I know you have a real busy schedule, and the article really piqued my interest, and I wouldn't feel right about myself had I not tried to reach you. If you like what Chief Ludwig had to say and want to learn some more, you can reach him on Facebook at Gary Ludwig. He's on Twitter at Chief Gary Ludwig, and he has a website, GaryLudwig.com. And feel free to drop him a line. You have a different opinion that you want to share. That some people think today that that's a horrible thing, that you're not part of the majority, exactly what it is, just to go and agree with it. You can have a dissenting opinion, We have the right to do that. And we should be willing and able to sit down and talk and discuss our opposing views and see what we can do to maybe compromise and be able to shake hands on a combined idea that we can present. And even if we can't, we should be able to shake our hands to agree to disagree. We don't need vitriol. We don't need hateful speech. We don't need tirades on Twitter. We just need to be people talking to each other. And if we can start doing that, we can do a lot to help improve the fire service. It'll help improve insurance care and health care. And most important, it's going to help our communities, the citizens who pay for us and what we do, and the oath that we took to protect them. It'll let us do that job a whole lot better. So thank you very much, Chief. Great talking with you. I hope we'll have you on again sometime in the next few months. You are a plethora of knowledge for the fire and EMS service. That would have been a 25-cent word my dad would have said. He likes plethora.
Yes, I do too.
So my
myriad thanks, is another way of saying a plethora. So.
Right, myriad is another great word. So thanks very much. And this podcast will be on this coming Monday, the 30th, and we have one for November the 6th as well, 5th, November the 4th as well. So tune in to 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. We thank you for listening, and we have a few more points, so we'll be right back after our words. And again, our sincere thanks to Chief Gary Ludwig for sitting in with us this evening and talking about what we need to do to create and generate successful health and insurance reform. We'll be right back.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Psst. Yeah, you. It's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa. What happened to us? We used to be so much more active. But lately, you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just going to keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
And that wraps another edition of 5 Alarm Task Force, news and issues for today's first responders. We would like to thank our guest, Chief Gary Ludwig, for joining us today to discuss healthcare reform or insurance reform, which will solve the problems. Did you know you can find us and subscribe to us on iTunes? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our partners, Dalmatian Productions, Inc., the Firehouse Tribune, Fire Tech, Hennessy Distributing, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, and the Great Florida Fire School. Portions of instrumental music on 5 Alarm Task Force are courtesy of Lee Rosevier. Find more of his music at happypuppyrecords.ca. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a comment about the show, please drop us a line to dalmatprod@outlook.com. We want to know that we're bringing you the topics that you are interested in. You can follow us on Twitter @dalmatprod or @cause_origin and stay up to date with all Dalmatian news and our blog at our new website, www.dalmatianproductions.tv. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, and let's make sure everyone goes home.